Hello, everyone. Today is April 4th, 2013, and welcome to the 12th session of Ontology Summit 2013, Ontology Evaluation Across the Life Cycle. My name is Michael Gruninger, and today, together with Matthew West, we are the co-chairs of this year's summit, and we will be facilitating today's meeting. Now, up to now, we have completed the virtual sessions of the summit that were dedicated to presentations of technical content. Each of the four tracks in this year's summit have hosted some very exciting presentations that address the key summit themes: intrinsic aspects of ontology evaluation, extrinsic aspects of ontology evaluation, building ontologies to meet evaluation criteria, and software environments for evaluating ontologies. In today's session, we will focus on revisiting the synthesis of all of these ideas as input into the initial draft of the summit communique. This is, in fact, our second synthesis session, and as before, the session will be framed by the communique outline. So what we'll be seeing today will be the different track champions. We'll provide discussion questions that represent the points of synthesis that they need to address, but feel they don't yet have enough input to synthesize. So we'll begin to have an overview of what people have done so far and kind of where people also need to get a little more content. So the agenda for today, I will begin with a few comments and observations of what we have looked at so far. Then Matthew West will present some slides giving his perspective on where the summit has been and where we want to go in the remaining weeks. And then what we'll do is we'll have, again, each of the tracks, A, B, C, and D, the different track champions will be presenting some of their slides that represent that synthesis. And then after that, we will have a discussion about the communique based on the communique outline that has been proposed in the communique draft that has been written by the co-lead editors, Fabian Neuhaus and Amanda Beisdom. And so that's we'll spend about a half hour on that kind of open Q&A discussion. Okay, so we can begin. If we go to slide two, I just wanted to identify a couple of what I thought might be some outstanding questions, questions that have been raised. And I think maybe we're still kind of working on. And these seem to be like two themes that, from my perspective, have kind of arisen here. The first is the role of requirements in ontology design, evaluation, implementation. And I think we all recognize that a comprehensive notion of requirements is really critical for ontology evaluation. And I think one of the key challenges that we have, though, is really, how do we identify the requirements that really arise from the ontology applications? So when we're looking at the extrinsic aspects, the context in which ontologies are designed, the context in which ontologies are being applied to real problems, I think we all recognize that that is where the source of the requirements for ontologies. But we still, I think, are kind of looking for ways in which we can really identify what those requirements are, ways in which we can capture those requirements and how to formalize those requirements so that they can feed into, say, concrete intrinsic properties of ontologies that can then be used to actually evaluate and guide, evaluate ontologies at different points of development and then guide the future development and revision of them. There's also questions kind of around, well, exactly how are these requirements used? How are they used at different points in at the initial kind of design of the ontology, how they're used in the analysis of the ontology, and how they're used in the testing of the ontology. I think this is kind of goes to the next point here, which is, in software design, we really see this idea that, you know, requirements should be testable, that you want to refine the requirements down to a point where when later on when you're doing building tests for the system, you can actually then say, okay, if the system passes this test, then it meets this particular requirement. And I think that's something we also need to keep in mind with ontologies, is that if we are talking about ontology requirements, we really need to refine them to the point where they are specific enough to be testable. And, you know, I'm conjecturing maybe here, this is maybe what we can see from the different intrinsic aspects track. And then the final point on this idea of the role of requirements in ontology evaluation is the distinction, again, we see in software engineering between verification and validation. So with verification, what we're saying is we have the set of requirements, we've kind of agreed on those, And now we are evaluating the, say, in our case, the ontology against those requirements. And so this is something that can be done, kind of looking at the ontology representation alone and then seeing how that matches up with the requirements. And then we can verify that, yes, we have the right ontology that meets those requirements. And there may be multiple ones. And then, you know, there are other ideas on how to kind of evaluate the multiple possibilities, but at least they have all kind of passed that set of requirements. And then validation is this other issue of, well, do we have the right requirements in the first place? And so I think that is something that also we're still working towards, is this idea of, well, given a particular intended application of ontologies, how do we know that we've extracted the right set of requirements from which we will evaluate our ontologies? And along these lines, there was the hackathon project, ontology of ontology evaluation exercise that occurred last weekend, and it had the task of building out subsections after the group had put together a high-level concept model to do kind of the requirements analysis. And so some of the output from that project, which is actually project HC05 in the hackathon, will be looking at producing some more ideas on ontology requirements. And so if you go to summit, if you look at actually I could post that URL, which was the, kind of contains the outcome of that. I'll just dip it in here. Hackathon. So then the other point I just wanted to mention on here, still on slide two, is this idea of ontology quality. I think Matthew will have some more words to say about this. And there's one question I just want to kind of put out there is, if we kind of look at the other requirements, the semantic requirements in an ontology, related to the axioms of your ontology and the kinds of inferences you can make from those axioms, if those are analogous to the functional requirements in software engineering, would non-functional requirements, the analogy of non-functional requirements, correspond to what we consider to be the quality of an ontology? So that's just a question I'm putting out there, maybe for future discussion. Moving to slide three, just a few thoughts. One of the very first ontology summit back in 2006, I guess it was called the ontology summit because it kind of gathered together a lot of stakeholders. That year, the topic was author ontologies, and it brought together the kind of different stakeholders, different representatives of the major upper ontologies. And the communique at that time was kind of a synthesis of all the different ideas that people were kind of thinking of with upper ontologies. And they kind of represented, some ideas on where to go in the future with respect to upper ontologies. And I think if we're looking at, this year as an ontology summit, I think, in a sense, we're all stakeholders in the question of ontology evaluation. And so as a community, I think we really need to have, when we're working on our communique here, we really need to kind of agree upon some common set of conditions for evaluating ontologies. And this, maybe these conditions, they don't make its way into the actual communique. It becomes some other kind of web resource. But I really think this is a challenge for us, again, as an ontology community, to come to an agreement about what we mean by the conditions for evaluating ontologies. And in a way, it's kind of like, what are our expectations for ontology evaluation? So someone says, oh, I have evaluated my ontology. Someone's submitting a paper to a conference or a journal and they say, I've evaluated my ontology. What are they expecting? Or for the referee, gives back the review of your paper and says, oh, there wasn't enough ontology evaluation. You didn't evaluate your ontology. So what does it mean when somebody says that? I think that's something we still need to articulate. And similarly, I think with ontology quality, right? Do we really have consensus on this idea of ontology quality when we're evaluating ontologies? So I'm leaving all these open threads here that we can pull apart either in discussion today or hopefully continue. We have a few more weeks before the actual symposium face-to-face on May 2nd and 3rd at NIST to maybe have some more email discussion. So on slide four, we just have a kind of an overview of what we'll be seeing today. Like for us putting here, Matthew will be giving some of his perspectives on the summit so far. But then after that, we'll be hearing from tracks A, B, C, and D, as you can see on that slide. And then we'll be wrapping up with a discussion about the communique led by Fabian and Amanda. So I guess what we can do now is, Matthew, if you want to talk about your perspectives on the summit so far.
Hi, Mike. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Thank you. Okay. These are some reflections on the summit and something about where we've got to and how far I think we have to go. And by the way, not necessarily, I think, just during the summit. Slide two, please. So, where we are. Well, we're talking about evaluation, and I actually think we need to be talking about quality. And the fact that we're not talking about quality is probably largely to a misunderstanding of what quality really is. Because we have, the one thing that I am pleased about is that we have recognized requirements is important. But what we don't seem to have got to yet is that quality is about meeting agreed requirements. That is, you know, in any formal quality management sense, that is what quality means. I know there's a more popular meaning of quality, which is just generally about how good something is, which always has the sense of, you know, should we be gold plating things and that sort of thing. But that's not what it means in the formal sense of quality management, and that's the sense in which quality is important. We don't know the properties of an ontology that are critical to its quality. And where we need to get to is that the critical properties of an ontology are broadly agreed and requirements are specified. And we know we can specify requirements for those things, I should say. There's not a good sense of a requirements hierarchy with linkages between levels. We've had some talk of capabilities, which are essentially very high level requirements. And we've talked about lower levels, and indeed, Michael was just talking about getting requirements down to the level where we can test them, which is exactly indeed what we need to do. But we're not really there yet, but that is where we need to get to. We need to get the way that higher level requirements for ontology are supported by lower level requirements, and the linkage between them is understood. Ontology is largely developed as code, directly in an implementation language, is where we are now. Where we need to be is ontology developed at a conceptual, logical, and physical level so that there are clear stages and intermediate deliverables before we get to putting it in code, by which I mean, you know, cutting some OWL or some common logic or some other language, formal language. There is no widely accepted development methodology for ontologies. It's not that there should only be one, but ontology development methodologies are available, taught and practiced, is where we need to get to. There are no ideas of ontology management maturity, never mind applying them in practice to organizational development. Where we need to get to is that ontology management maturity models are available and used to guide the use and management of ontologies in enterprises. So that's how I see the lay of the land at the moment in terms of where we are and where we need to get to. Now, let me just put a bit of flesh on some of those things about where we need to get to and why. Slide three, please. So the first thing is just to reflect, really, that the thing that ontologies deliver to us at the end of the day is information. And the primary purpose of information is to support decision taking. Now, it's a different kind of way that information is provided from reasoning, but it's still basically you ask a question, you get an answer, and then you make use of that answer. And the way that you get benefits out of an ontology is just like any other information system, that it helps you make better decisions, and that in doing that, that reduces your business risks, makes you more responsive to change, it increases your effectiveness, and it reduces your costs. So you should be able to look at an ontology and go straight to working out what the benefits are in financial terms, and you should be able to look at the quality of your ontology in financial terms as well. And I don't think anyone suggested that yet. Slide four, please. Now, when you look at quality management, the base thing that we look at is ISO 9001, which on the one hand is much maligned, but on the other hand is actually a really good description, if it's properly used, of what you need to do in order to have quality management of something. This is, I've very slightly adapted this so that down at the bottom right, the sort of orangey box, says information product, whereas in the original it says just product. But information is a product, and there's an information product realization process next to it, which is what goes between the requirements and the customers, the information product and the customers, and then you can measure the satisfaction of the customers in the measurement, analysis, and improvement. But even those are only two things. So, for instance, the whole of the life cycle of an ontology would be incorporated within the information product realization process. You have the measurement, analysis, and improvement, but the two key bits here are the management responsibility and the resource management. And this is about making sure that you have the resources necessary to provide the information and to manage its quality. And the management responsibility is about people at the top of the business understanding and taking responsibility for the fact that information quality and the way that it's provided, for instance, through ontologies, is important, and to ensure that those resources are available. Now, that's a much broader sense of what it is that is needed than I've seen anywhere else. Next slide, please, slide 5. Now, the next thing, and I think we may well be able to get to this during this ontology summit, is key properties that determine the quality. Now, this is for information, but in principle, something very similar to this should be possible for ontologies as well, which are just a way of providing information. Not necessarily exactly these things, but something broadly similar is what I would hope for. You need that an ontology or information in any form has lots of properties. Most of them will not actually be that critical when it comes to looking at the quality. A few of them turn out to be critical, and these are the ones that, in my experience, have been most critical, at least over that time. So relevance, did this help answer the question? Is the scope right? Clarity, is it clear what the information means? Accessibility and security. Consistency, is information from different sources consistent and comparable? Provenance, do I know where this came from? Timeliness, completeness, do I have all the information that I need? Do I have it when I need it for taking the decisions? Accuracy, how close to the truth is it? We're not talking about precision here. And the cost benefit, is the cost of acquiring the information worth the benefit I get from having the information available to support my decision taking? So that's for information. I've seen quite a lot that's quite close to something like this that could emerge, but I've not seen, there are some of these that I haven't seen involved, and I've seen many others that might support some of these things, for example. Okay, next slide, slide 6, please. Now, the next question is, for me, is how does ontology fit into enterprise architecture? Because if you're going to get ontology into the enterprise, it's going to go in through the enterprise architecture, certainly for any large organization. What I can tell you is that all the elements on here play a role in that information quality process. You need all of these things somewhere in the information quality process in order to support that process. So what is it that makes how an ontology would fit into here? You can see reasonably clearly that things like the corporate data model and reference data and the transactions are going to be ontology related, but that's at an integrating ontology level, not at a reasoning level. So a reasoning ontology will be some other kind of thing perhaps next to physical data models, I don't know. But where does it fit? How does it fit? That's something that we need to work out, and that's something we need to explain to organizations so that they know how it fits into the way their enterprise works. Slide number 7, please. Next slide. And then finally, maturity. This is, again, is for information because that's what I know most about. But the same kind of thing you need to have for ontology management. A maturity model goes through typically 5 stages, from initial through to optimizing. What you find is that going through these stages is about putting in place, or whether you have in place, what level you are at, is largely about putting in place and using the enterprise architecture that I was showing earlier. Actually understanding not just that you've got these things, but that you're using them appropriately, particularly at the managing and the optimizing level. There's a lot of struggle about that, but I've not seen anything about maturity of ontology management, not even hinted at. And I think that's my last slide. Is there another slide, Peter?
No, that's it.
Okay. So just to wrap up, I think what you can see from this is something about the overall journey there is to go and something about where we are relative to that journey. And we've certainly made some progress this summit. But there is really quite a long way to go, and I think that we need to think in terms of a few years of getting some of these things in place so that we can explain what it is we do in the terms that enterprises are going to understand, and that they can relate to and see why this is going to be right for them. And that will mean things like not just having requirements, but understanding how meeting them is going to deliver benefits to the business. All the requirements we've looked at have been rather technical, not financial, for instance. We need to look at how it's going to fit into the enterprise architecture. We need to understand how a quality management system works around ontologies, and we need to understand how ontology management maturity, what that means as a framework. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Matthew. All right. So those are the perspectives, I guess, from the two of us co-chairs. So now we'll kind of move into part of the today's session, where we will hear some ideas related to the synthesis of all of the summit results so far from the specific perspectives of each track. So the first track A, intrinsic aspects of ontology evaluation, I believe Steve Ray will be presenting the ideas that him and Leo have put together. Steve?
Yeah, can you hear me well?
Yes.
Okay, so as you say, what Leo and I have been trying to do here on this presentation is collect what we've been observing and hearing during these various past sessions from the perspective of the intrinsic aspects, but also fitting those synthesized ideas into the context of what will ultimately comprise the communique. So we've got some thoughts on that as well, which you'll see. If you go to slide number 2 of our deck, I'm just going to walk you briefly through some of the material, which is a reprise of what we had at the first synthesis session, so I'll try and move through that rather quickly and then address the new perceptions. So I think we all agree that ultimately the bottom line on the worth of an ontology is, does it do the job? And that's, I think we're all agreeing that. That falls outside of just the focus of the intrinsic evaluation, but we're saying a piece of the overall worth of an ontology is the aspects, if you like, of the structural or domain-independent sort of intrinsic things before you get to the meeting the customer's requirements at the end of the analysis. So there's things you can do to see if the thing's well built, basically. You know, have you done a good job building it? Or is this thing chewing gum and string and just barely makes it, but boy, it's going to fall apart the first time something changes. So some examples at the bottom of slide two there are just examples of things that have been brought forward. You know, there's, for example, well, obviously the proper use of the various kinds of relations. Are you using well-defined relations that are out there, such as subclass, things like that, obviously, in the proper way? The second sub-bullet there, the distinction between concepts and facts, or if you want to think of classes and instances, is sometimes a judgment call from the domain perspective. You know, when do you stop subclassing and when do you just say, no, now we're talking about an instance? And that indeed at times depends upon the scope and the perspective of the user. So there's a bit of extrinsic, if you like, or domain related stuff there. Data types, things that you just want to clean up, make sure you do correctly. And I'm just going to keep going, but you'll see like consistent range and domain constraints. These are examples that came up, for example, with Maria Poveda's oops. If you have a symmetric relation, you sure better not have the range and domain different, because how can it be symmetric if it's not the same group on the each side? So those are just some examples of things that are fairly readily testable in a domain-independent way. So what we're doing and what we're collecting in Track A then is trying to capture, list all of those different kinds of metrics and the properties themselves, things that Matthew just said, you know, would constitute some of these quality measures, as well as touch on some of the methods of how one should or could go about measuring those measures. With the overall aim, obviously, of raising the quality, which is exactly what Matthew has been saying in a previous talk as well, quality in the broad sense, in the formal sense. That was, sorry, slide three. If you move on to slide four, so, again, here are some of the questions one might ask, which would lead to the formal metrics of what are you going to actually measure, and then the methods by which one would go about measuring those metrics. So these are the driving questions, if you like, the requirements for intrinsic quality. You know, are checking, are there inconsistencies, are there errors, is it structurally sound, and what does that mean? You know, how do we gauge that? Is it specifically calling out what are the measures for that? How are you going to go about measuring structural soundness? Is it modular? Again, touches on some domain knowledge there to know what would be appropriate to be modular. But certainly from a structural perspective, again, you don't, if you have lots and lots of cross-links between modules, well, then those aren't really nice and modular according to one, you know, any of various criteria there. Sound principles of logic, etc. Again, now the second to last bullet there touches into the fact that we can't totally separate the domain-independent intrinsic measures with the less or the somewhat domain-dependent versus the, you know, customer requirement-focused. So this is a spectrum. We recognize that from intrinsic to extrinsic evaluation, and one can think of it, and is it useful to think of intrinsic evaluation as some sort of white box or glass box testing paradigm. Slide five, please. Because of that, Leo and I have been talking, and Leo came up with a little diagram of slicing the evaluation spectrum, if you like, into the sort of more or less intrinsic and the more or less extrinsic aspects. And then within each of those categories, you know, we have the purely structural intrinsic, purely and easily identified as domain independent intrinsic aspects. Then we got some of these that I had called out in the last few minutes of the domain intrinsic aspects, you know, things like the modularity, for example. And we presumed that there would be a similar way one could separate or spread out some of the extrinsic aspects, but we defer to the Track B group to determine whether or not, in fact, that makes sense in the extrinsic world. we find it useful in the intrinsic. So we submit this kind of spectrum as a possibility for the communique, for Fabian and Amanda to consider whether this helps in the overall description of the evaluation world. So let me move on to that on slide 6. On the purely structural, then, doesn't depend at all on knowledge of the domain, and I'll give you some examples of that. It's much more, if you like, mathematical and logical, not domain, looking at consistency, things you can actually run tools over and get answers. Those are the sort of binary, is it good or bad kinds of tests. Bullet 3 talks about some of the more numerical metrics kinds of tests, like branching factor and density and averages, things like that, where you can perhaps gain insight as to the construction of the ontology, whether it's very sparse and every superclass just has like maybe 2 subclasses, or does every superclass have, you know, 8 subclasses, and what does that mean? The other properties that, again, are tested in some of the tools we've seen, transitivity, symmetry, reflexivity, these kinds of things have entailments, if you like, consequences. If one declares a property to be symmetric, then there are certain follow-on requirements that flow from that. And so anyway, mostly domain independent. In contrast, on slide 7, we have what we are calling the domain intrinsic evaluations now, as opposed to the structural intrinsic evaluations, where you do need a little bit of knowledge to see whether you are doing some structural things correctly. And if you look at bullet 2, for example, the notions of rigidity and identity, the kinds of things that you even see in AutoClean, well, deciding whether something's a rigid property or not needs some knowledge of what it is you're modeling, so you have to know a bit about that. Let's see, I'm just reading ahead myself, so I know what I'm saying here, we are bringing up the notion of AutoClean there on bullet number 3. Again, how you even go about sort of framing the ontology will depend upon the knowledge. You know, are you going to approach it as a sort of a process-oriented perspective, or a sort of object, or, you know, thing-oriented perspective, or an event-oriented perspective? That again, obviously needs domain knowledge as to what perspective that ontology is going to take. And then the last bullet simply points out that these things are a spectrum, and at the edges, you're going to have to make a judgment call whether you're going to decide to categorize that as a structural intrinsic, a domain intrinsic, or some sort of extrinsic evaluation, if it matters. Slide 8, now we get to some of the examples then, and I think almost by definition, the OOPS tool is a structural intrinsic evaluation tool by virtue of the fact that you can throw any ontology at it, and it obviously has no knowledge of what it is you're talking about, but it will come up with some measures, some tests, as to whether there's a problem in that ontology. And Maria, I know, has gone out of her way to say that you can't just definitively say it's wrong. The user or the owner of the ontology will have to decide whether this thing has been flagged is indeed a problem or is appropriate, and that was where their domain knowledge will come in. But there are structural things that can be tested, as I explained, for example, her test on symmetric properties, for example, if the domain and the range are different classes, then you got a bit of a problem. AutoQA, again, is taking the metrics approach, not the sort of the pass-fail, but more what are these measures that might be informative on determining some of these structural properties. On slide number 9, we get now into a bit of domain knowledge being needed to use these tools. The OQUARE framework, which we heard about, has a bit of both, and they recognize during the discussions that there's probably a better could be an improvement on how to separate, or they would like at least to better separate which places need the domain knowledge and which places don't. And then we made reference, or in the past, to the EntreClean, which many people know about, was not presented in this summit, but certainly stands as a great early example of some intrinsic property evaluation or ontology evaluation from years ago. So on slide 10, we wanted to touch on the fact of the point that's been raised about, are we addressing properly in this summit the notion of the life cycle? And we're at the conclusion that, well, sometimes things that might be flagged as errors at one point might be relaxed later in the life cycle. And if you look at the third major bullet, first sub-bullet on slide 10, you can see where you might be early on in the design saying, I've got to at least check everything's logically consistent. But then later in the life cycle, when you're moving toward the application, you might recognize there are some times when you need to maintain some logically inconsistent statements at the same time for one purpose or another from the customer's perspective. So there may be examples of those kinds of things where during the initial early design or during the later application development, there will be different sets of criteria as to what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. Open world, closed world was another example that Leo put on this slide. Slide number 11 then is sort of a restatement of what Leo had presented earlier about the phased approach, the life cycle phased approach for evaluation. And he's filled in, and I will just have to defer to Leo on this, but he was putting in some examples of what kinds of questions one might ask at the different phases, the early phases of analysis, the multiple stages of design that take place, both at early stages and then the redesign phases later where you're coming back after having had interactions with users and all. So hopefully this slide will be useful in the communique to frame the larger context. And I will make a final note that I hope in the early outline of the communique, there were a number of requirements, if you like, that were stated, which were, most if not all of them, were extrinsic in nature, and I would urge that we include at least one bullet in those early requirements, recognizing the value of some intrinsic or structural evaluation at most phases of the life cycle. So with that, I think that's the end of our synthesis so far.
Thank you, Steve. Yeah, a lot of great ideas there, summarizing the track A. So up next, track B, the extrinsic aspects of ontology evaluation, Terry and Todd. I'm not sure who is presenting.
I can. I think Terry's sick, or at least may have trouble talking.
Okay.
Is that true, Terry? No comment. Okay. Answers that question. Am I coming across loud enough, Michael?
Yes.
Okay, well, track B talked about extrinsic aspects of evaluation. So, Peter, if you pop over to slide 2. This is a repeat of the mission summary. My screens are redrawing slowly, so I assume that you're already seeing that. I don't want to go over this in any great detail. You can read it if you haven't already. It's on the website. Let me point out, though, that it has become apparent that the notion of intrinsic and extrinsic is probably not a good distinction to be made. And in particular, for track B, as we were asked to do, we looked at extrinsic aspects of evaluation, and what we adopted was a black box approach. You heard Steve and Leo mention the white box view that they had, and that's appropriate. However, what we pointed out, even with a black box approach, the notion of the boundary of where the black box is changes, or you can be construed to change over the course of the life cycle. And Steve did mention this very nice OOPS tool. Well, The OOPS tool can be considered a looking at an ontology from a black box perspective. It doesn't know anything about the domain. It's just looking at it, and it's running some tests on it without great knowledge. So the notion of where the boundary of a black box is variable. Subsequently, you can sort of deduce from that that this distinction between intrinsic and extrinsic is probably a distraction. And as was pointed out, if you looked at the last slide from Steve and Leo's, the number of steps that you go through really shouldn't be making that distinction as clearly as we did for the summit. So with that, if we go on to slide 3, please. What did we put on slide 3? So one of the things that we heard about was the scope of evaluation. And as was pointed out very explicitly, is that the ontology evaluation takes place in some context. And that context is going to impart a scope of applicability or validity to your evaluation. And, of course, that context and scope impacts your evaluation criteria and the importance that you may place on them. Now, as Matthew pointed out, one of the things that we did not talk about explicitly, though from a systems engineering perspective, which we did adopt for the extrinsic view, cost certainly is a driving value. If it's too expensive to build, people aren't going to do it. If the cost of finding expertise to actually implement and use ontologies is too expensive, you're not going to do it. So certainly cost is an issue, and that falls into the realm of the scope of what you're evaluating and the context thereof. So one of the things we can draw out of this is you need to identify the context or scope of your evaluation, and then you can use it to rank the evaluation criteria. So if we go on to slide 4, another aspect that was brought up was the reuse, i.e., reuse of existing techniques and paradigms. Now, maybe not direct reuse, but you could modify things. So there are already lots of systems and software paradigms and processes for evaluating things in those areas. And I believe we all agree that ontologies and their infrastructure fall into this realm. Now, relational databases do bear a strong resemblance or similarity to ontologies, and was shown to us by Mary Balboni, I think convincingly, that many of the techniques that they use in database testing and validation and evaluation can be applied in some fashion to ontologies. So, you know, some of the criteria or tests are error conditions, degraded modes of operation, load capacity testing, and performance. And I have to stress that, as we all know, you can develop a beautiful ontology, it can perform so poorly, no one's going to use it. So performance is an issue. It's certainly an extrinsic criteria, I will agree. And then there's the issue of the ontology itself and the instance data integrity. And I want to bring this out strongly, is that we consider the ontology as part of a system. Now, that system does have a goal, and as part of that goal and its implementation and or use in your system, there are going to be users, whether they're humans, people, or chipmunks, are going to be interacting with the ontology and its instance data. And in terms of reuse and testing and evaluation, you have to evaluate how those interfaces are performing and or behaving with respect to the intent of the ontology and the overall system. So if you allow your users to create instance data, update it, and or delete things, you do have to test that what they will end up doing in terms of the overall knowledge base is going to be consistent with the domain of usage and the requirements thereof, or therefore. So if we go on to slide 5, security. I didn't hear much of anything about this. Matthew did bring up the issue of access, but I want to bring up a larger issue of security vulnerabilities of the systems that are using the ontologies. And, of course, the example that pops to mind is an SQL injection attack from relational databases. So now, because the ontology is embedded or in some degree in your system, and there are interactions with that ontology from other parts of your system, you may be introducing security vulnerabilities. It may be a security vulnerability that actually impacts the domain or the domain knowledge presented, inferences that are being drawn, or just other aspects where the attacker can get into your larger environment through your vulnerability in your system that does have the ontology. But the important point is not much has been thought about in this area or talked about. So we believe it's an open area of research. Now, of course, I want to say the ontology by themselves may pose no risk. However, the way that they are embedded or used in a system and their interactions with other components of the system may provide the opportunity to introduce vulnerabilities. Okay, so if we go on to slide 6, dynamics. This is another aspect that I didn't hear much about, and that is ontologies allow a system to have more dynamic capabilities than can be had with relational databases or other more static, less dynamic knowledge representation mechanisms. And in the course of a system operating, it may change, i.e. if the system is semi-autonomous and it has ability to learn, extend the ontology now, and not just the knowledge, not just the instance data, change its theory over time, I don't believe our existing systems of software evaluation paradigms are applicable, that they really can't address this sort of situation. So how are we going to evaluate ontologies that are allowed to change over time while the system is in operation? Now, there might be some hope with simulations, and we were given this presentation from the NEMO project from Dr. Almeida that might suggest there are ways that we could address this issue. But overall, the notion of ontologies changing over the life of operation or over the life of their use in operation of a system has not been considered. If we go on to slide 7, automation. Okay, well, ontologies can be difficult, and if we are going to have them used in regular systems development, then we're going to have to some extent conform to existing testing paradigms and processes. And in general, people who are doing the testing do not have great technical knowledge of the things that they are testing. Now, that's not always the case, but we should assume that our testers are not going to be ontology experts. So what can we do to automate or provide support to automate some of this testing capability? And again, this is from a systems perspective. We're at integration and test phase. We've done our development. We've done some initial intrinsic testing, if you like, some unit testing along the way, and now we're doing integration testing before we ship that puppy. So there are tools that automate some of this for software currently, and what comes to mind is, you know, regression analysis. You can do that. Now, in fact, you could use those same tools for testing a system with an ontology to some extent. But right now, we don't have many tools that I know of that can automate the testing of a system with an ontology that can point back to problems with the ontology directly. However, we did hear that there are some projects underway that might help with this. In particular, I'm thinking of Megan Katsumi's work. So if we go on to slide 8, requirements. As was pointed out, these are the basis for any evaluation. And in general, not just ontologies, but for software, for systems, for almost anything. If you don't know what you want to evaluate, why you want to evaluate it, what the values or value ranges are, you know, you can do whatever you want and sell it. And we do agree that requirements are extrinsic toward the ontology itself, and requirements are not designed. And if you've ever done requirements development and analysis, you know it can be quite tedious to avoid boxing yourself in very quickly to design the solution in. We do lack a consistent capability to create these specifications that are going to really represent the semantic requirements as needed by our end customer and the operational needs that they have. Now, many times a customer come in and say, I want this thing to do blah. Well, they don't tell you necessarily all of the operational needs that they actually have implicit or in their own mind, and you have to extract that. We also have to have a way to create the specifications that are going to really help us describe the intended interpretations of the ontology and the models or the models thereof. And most importantly, these things have to be easily translatable into tests, quantifiable, metrizable tests that can be executed by humans or other automated systems. So if we can't really write down these requirements, then evaluations are not going to work, and we're going to fail to meet expectations. And again, we know that a lot of requirements, development, and analysis has to do with controlling or framing expectations. Now, we should also assume that any requirements that are going to have to be developed, derived, or the processes thereof are going to have to be worked in the context of systems and software engineering and the requirements that we get from them. Then someone's not going to come out and give you a very specific set of specifications as to what your ontology should do in general. At least I've never seen it. I wouldn't expect that for the near future. If we go on to slide 9, more requirements, 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 requirements. So, as was pointed out already, and we actually, Amanda gave us a nice presentation about an idea for a process for developing these requirements, we have to have requirements to go across the entire life cycle of the ontology. We have to be able to specify the right level of detail at that life cycle phase. We have to be able to associate those requirements or the processes with the operational uses that are going to be made of the ontology and the system in which it's embedded. We also have to account for the complexity that the system may have if it's employing ontologies. For instance, you know, autonomous systems or systems that might be able to learn and expand the ontology and all over. What else here? Oh, yes, testing and testing paradigms. There are a lot of them out there already, so our requirements processes are going to have to develop requirements and specifications that fit into that and that also support the automated testing and evaluation. So if we can do this, it's a lot of work, and as was pointed out, it's not going to happen overnight. We'll be able to provide these testable criteria, improve the ontology development use, and most importantly, couple the ontology use to deliverable systems, i.e., give people confidence that they can do this. It's not a big risk. So if we go on to the last slide, 10, so some recommendations. As was already pointed out, we need to develop this process that are going to lead to the appropriate requirements across the life cycle so we can constrain the interpretations correctly. And it might be the case that we could start out by looking at patterns for requirements development, just as they do in software and other areas. From the notion of identifying the patterns for requirements, we may be then able to come up with more detailed specifications as to how they should be derived. And if we can develop these reliable methods and tools, we should be able to create these testable criteria, improve ontology development use, and again, couple the ontology to the deliverable systems. And that's all for Track B. All of this material is on our synthesis page if you'd like to look at it with full English sentences. Thank you.
Thank you, Todd and Terry. So moving on to Track C, Building Ontologies to Meet Evaluation Criteria, led by Matthew West and Mike Bennett, and I believe Matthew will be presenting the slides today.
Yes, that's me. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, I'm sorry it's me again. So this is looking at where we've got to with methodologies for building ontologies to meet evaluation criteria, looking at, again, after the second round of presentations that we had. Slide 2, please. So one of the things that we picked up is that amongst the desirable characteristics of ontologies, that for integrating ontologies, consistency was a critical property. And that achieving consistency across large and potentially geographically and culturally diverse development and maintenance teams is a particular challenge in methodology development. Slide 3, please. In terms of best practices, the main thing that we picked up on was the need to develop or get to developing ontologies at a number of stages, just as has been good practice in developing data models for two or three decades now at least, so that you would have distinct conceptual, logical, and physical levels. You might not call them that, but you need to have something which is equivalent. requirements need to be identified in levels two, and they would go with these conceptual, logical, and physical levels, and you would start to bring things in at those different levels. What I would imagine coming in at a conceptual, logical, and physical level is that a conceptual level would introduce the key concepts and the relations between those. The logical level would introduce the axioms, and the physical level would be a coding of all that in some processable language, like OWL or Common Logic or some such. But that the conceptual and logical levels would be kept independent of the kinds of compromises that you might need to make when you went to a physical level. Requirements need to be identified in levels two. So for systems capabilities, we need ontology capabilities, we need ontology requirements to support capabilities, and property values for key properties to support capabilities. So there's a clear hierarchy there. And we need an architectural approach. So this means understanding things like the ontological commitments the ontology needs to make and does make, the ontology language that you're going to choose and work towards at an implementation level, and the overall implementation environment. Slide four, please. Tool support. One thing is clear. There is little or no integrated tool support for multi-level, multi-stage ontology development. There are, of course, some tools to directly support the development of ontologies at the physical level. This isn't desperately surprising. If you look at the history of data models, exactly the same thing happened there in the first place. You started with tools that would directly create databases, and then you work back from there to tools that could support logical data models, and back from there to tools that would support conceptual data models. So where we are is not that surprising. Slide five, please. I think there is one. Yes, future steps. So what are the key things that we need to be doing as we move forward? A better understanding of the relationships between requirements at different levels. Ontology development methodologies that align with and recognize similar stages to information systems development with distinct conceptual, logical, and physical stages. By the way, there are multiple reasons for this. Well, one of the key reasons is that it fits with an already familiar information systems development methodologies that most larger organizations will be adopting anyway, and enables you to link into information systems development at different stages and program development at different stages. A clearer understanding of the architecture of ontology development and the different aspects of architecture that are relevant from ontological commitments to language choices. Thank you very much. That's all I had.
Okay, thank you, Matthew. Yeah, I really like the idea of the best practices slide. I think that's something else maybe we can try to identify somewhere and somehow in this summit is kind of identifying what the best practices are, so then see other people can replicate them in with their own ontologies. So then the last track that we'll be hearing from, track D, software environments for evaluating ontologies, that is championed by Mike Denny and Peter Yim, and I believe Mike, you will be presenting the slides.
Yes.
Great.
So we'll start with slide two. One of the advantages or disadvantages, depending on your perspective, of being the last speaker is that most of the interesting insights have already been noted, but we'll be sharing in some of those as I go through here, and I'll highlight where we seem to be have common ground. And then there are a few additional insights that I don't think have been discussed yet, so we'll try to zero in on those. Just to frame things, track D is a little different than the other tracks, which all focus on the nature of quality, as some have seen it, and the evaluation thereof. But Track D looks at more at the means of achieving that valuation. So really the first point I'd like to point out is that the way it's worded now and the slot that we have in the preliminary outline for the communique has us talking about supporting the evaluation of the characteristics identified in the tracts A through C. But it's our perspective is that tools contribute to the quality of ontologies in more ways than just evaluation, which I see more as a kind of post hoc operation where you've got an extant ontology and you want to assess its quality, perhaps for a candidate for reuse, or just to validate the ontology at the end of a development cycle. But rather, I think that tools today, and perhaps even more so in the future, can be conducting that evaluation of quality factors that are both structural and perhaps more content-oriented over the course of the design and the building of the ontology itself and even the validation phase of the ontology. So, we'd like to see that the notion of a tool's guidance in terms of getting the author of an ontology to a quality endpoint, quality product, is just as important and relevant as evaluation per se is. So many tools, you know, just do that as a matter of course because they restrict or constrict what an author can do. And hopefully the ways that they constrict or restrict things is beneficial to the ontology. But tools can go farther and, you know, also flag elements of an ontology as it's being built that may not be an error per se, but may bode to less than good practice. Or they may just be suggestive pop-ups saying, okay, you've got a, as it came up earlier, a symmetric relationship. You've just defined this as a symmetric property, let's say an all, so make sure that the domain and range match. Or maybe it just automatically forces the range to match the domain or vice versa, or prompt the user to say, which of these do you want to be the common class set. So we've got a broader view, and it's somewhat like, I guess, the distinction between a couple of different development methodologies between, let's say, agile development and waterfall development. Clearly, evaluation per se, and the way it seems to have been interpreted or at least discussed up to now is more like a waterfall event. And I think that there's lots of room for a much more agile built-in assessment of ontology quality over the course of the ontology lifecycle. We also noted that the ability of ontology tools to evaluate the ontology quality and fitness, are going to have to depend on these ontology characteristics that gain some common recognition as being indicative of ontology quality and fitness. So we've ultimately the tools and ultimately sort of our position in terms of the communique is going to have to reference ontology tools to those accountable factors that are being identified in tracts A through C. Now, at this point, I'm talking about quality and fitness. So that in track D, anyway, we've made a distinction which is similar but not quite the same as has been done in other tracks, where the notion of quality for us, we've attributed more as like model quality. Okay, what is the representational quality of whatever the domain is that the ontology is representing? And fitness is more of the domain fidelity and the domain scope that are achieved in the ontology. So I note in my, I guess, third bullet on this slide two, I'm relating quality more or less to, and that is a tilde that prepends the word there, relating it more or less to intrinsic factors and fitness to extrinsic factors. But if I was wanting to map it more to the track A view of things, I guess that rather than intrinsic, the quality there, what we mean by the quality or model quality would be a structural, would be those structural characteristics that track A talks about, while extrinsic would be the main characteristics that track A talks about. So maybe at the end we can resolve the terminology being used here in the communique. So the result that we may get from the ontology quality software survey that is out there in the public now, but I think needs to be better promoted, and I'll try to work on that. But the results, to the extent we have them, I think will be most useful if they're aligned to the priorities, if one can set priorities of the characteristics that the tracks A through C have identified and described. So, and there hasn't been any discussion at this point about prioritizing, if that's a word, but of setting priorities on the characteristics that have been identified in the track. But if so, it would then become an interesting exercise to see how the existing ontology tools map to those priorities. And so a simple gap analysis may identify some very important characteristics, at least as deemed by the tracks, that are not represented or covered by the available tools. And then thinking about the communique a little further, still on the bottom of slide two, the notion of tools and how the tools could implement the various evaluation and guidance factors for achieving quality and fitness, I think it would, rather than being in a separate section, might better be introduced as one discusses each of the track focuses in that regard. And that's already been done, I see, in a number of the presentations on the tracks. There is reference to tools. So, anyway, I put that out there as a suggestion for the organization of the communique, which would then essentially eliminate the section that's in reference in the top of in the first bullet of this page. So on slide three, one of the things that we did in this track was identify at a kind of upper level what we thought were the principal life cycle phases for ontology. And the survey that we put together actually was organized that way, where we had to some extent different capabilities represented for different phases of the life cycle. Now, there is a lot of commonality across the life cycles, in, I think, track A, it was pointed out that, or suggested that, you know, all of the characteristics should really be attended to in all of the phases of the life cycle. And then that may be too true from the just perspective of the project development, but from the perspective of tools per se, a tool that is able to assess a characteristic, let's say in the build phase, may not be able to assess that same characteristic in the design phase. Maybe that tool doesn't even have any support for the design elements of ontology building. So, but what we ended up with was a simple crossing of the of life cycle phases with this distinction between what we were calling model quality and domain and application fitness. So here I've also made a slight distinction that I'm not sure was made in the earlier presentations. Where when I'm talking about domain and application fitness, I'm really lumping together a couple of things. What domain being the fidelity and scope, in terms of the application fitness, this is really the viewpoint that's forced by the intended use of this ontology and the sort of impedance, the requirements for an impedance match between the ontology itself and whatever application it's going to be used in. You could separate those. Right now they're lumped together. I actually think that they're truly separate, and you really do have model quality, domain fidelity and scope, and application fitness as three separate categories. But that's just food for thought. On slide 4, we talk a little bit further about the life cycles. We've proposed a particular sort of simple breakdown of life cycles. I note that in track, in one of the tracks, was that track A, but there was a rather detailed, more detailed breakdown of life cycle. I think that it will be, whatever breakdown we use, I think that it would be useful to include if not a seminal, at least some preliminary description of the life cycle steps in the communique. Because, I mean, not only is assessing or achieving the quality dependent on the particular life cycle, I think that the entry points in terms of the tools and building and whether you're identifying things for reuse or not, are all dependent as well on life cycle and choosing the right step. That's sort of what the next bullet on this slide is talking about, because different tools may service different phases better, one to the other, and that may further vary on the particular characteristic or characteristics of the ontology that are being assessed. Or guided at that point in the development step. So, finally, on this slide, the way that ontology quality is viewed and determined is also going to depend on the requirements, and this has been, well pointed out earlier, the requirements that are afoot for this ontology development. And it's probably important that for any requirements or any ontology quality assessments, there is some ability to reference it back to initial requirements for the ontology. Whether that's within a tool environment, a kind of automatic or computable notion, or whether it's just simply a kind of manual ability to link requirements to particular quality characteristics is probably still important. So on slide five, we're talking a bit about using quality tools. Now, and I really don't, I mean, there are the two distinct ways that I talked about in the beginning, where it's either sort of built into a development environment, or maybe it's a standalone tool that you apply to extant ontologies after the fact. But it's important to recognize when we're talking about tools that there may be lots of aspects of ontologies that are not amenable to assessment or guidance and control by the software tool and software development environment, or ontology tool and ontology development environment. You know, so for example, when it comes to naming and defining ontology terms in clear and concise and cogent ways, it's probably unlikely that tools are going to be much used. Recently, there's been several exchanges now about sort of natural language in the forum, anyway, natural language on ontology. From that, I was reminded that which we call a rose by another name that smells sweet, phrase that we seemed there's this tendency, and I don't know how you diffuse it within a tool environment or within an overall ontology development environment, but there's this phenomenon which I'm calling lexical glare, where the name, the particular phrasing and words that are used to both name an ontology term or the concept that denoted by that term and the definition itself can often lead people to interpret the concept strictly in those terms, or at least hastily do so, rather than realizing that the meaning, at least within that ontology, is defined exclusively by its axiom. That's an aside. Another area where, it can be difficult for software tools to help very much is in the fitness of the ontology in terms of knowing what the whether you've got good domain fidelity and the appropriate scope for your ontology and as it's going to be used, or even knowing, although this may be more amenable to tool assessment, knowing whether you've got the proper utility in terms of its application domain, and that your ontology is going to work, it's going to make things doable and efficient within the context of that application. So on slide six, I think it's also important to note that there are some significant new tools for ontology evaluation that are on the waterfront, like OOPS, and so we need to make sure that recognition is there in the communique. But sort of overall, and this has been touched upon, I think, in some of the other tracks, I'm not sure it's been discussed explicitly. It seems to me that from a tools perspective, these tools, both the development and evaluation tools, would really do well especially if we're developing ontologies for, say, enterprise interoperability and the like, would really do well to be part of or at least integrated well, communicating well with the classic tools that are being used for enterprise IT and data modeling and the like today. So for, you know, like enterprise architect and systems architect tools, I've never, and maybe some people out there know, but I've never seen any remarks about linking ontology development or evaluation tools to the these IT development tools. And I think it's probably in the long run very important for the future of ontology. And it gives us that direct way of tying things to requirements that has been discussed so much today. So, you know, if you've got Enterprise Architect and you've got the Doors plugin to Enterprise Architect, then Doors gives you a way of sort of semi-formally anyway expressing requirements. And then maybe those, you know, with a little work could be actually expressed formally as well. Okay, and so finally, there are some possibilities for new tool use cases, at least, if not new tools per se, that are worth thinking about that haven't been mentioned. And one of them that comes to mind is the, and this relates, I think, fairly closely to the OOR initiative, that if you have a body, a repository of ontologies, during the course of doing a new ontology development, if that tool was constantly pinging your repository to look for similarities, in other words, trying to match the sort of the incipient coding that you've got there, or specification even, that you've got there, and find matches within the repository, that could give you a lot of guidance in more than one way. I mean, it could, you know, reveal coding patterns that you may want to borrow that you didn't have completed, but turn out to be quite similar to those that reside in the repository, or that just your approach in general in terms of your ontology building matches other ontologies, or that, you know, even particular code snippets are the same, might give you some confidence that you're doing things right or wrong. And then it would also give you more visibility into places where you could borrow from that repository and perhaps wholesale reuse of existing resources. And then finally, we hopefully will have gained further insight from the hackathon and clinic experiences, which we can incorporate into this body of the communique. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. Okay, so that kind of wraps up the presentations from each of the track champions over what's happened over the past last half of the summit presentations and some synthesis and key insights that they've garnered from all of those discussions. If everyone goes to the go to the session page and go to purple number 3Q71, it's part of the agenda. So this is item number 4 in our agenda, the Q&A and discussion about the communique. So if you can find the communique outline as proposed so far just by clicking on that link there. And at this point, I'd like to hand it over to Fabian and Amanda to maybe kind of facilitate a discussion over the next, say, 20 minutes, kind of about the communique. There can be some general questions about some of the presentations maybe after we get through that, but if we kind of focus our initial discussions just kind of on how, you know, what people have heard today, what people have been thinking about MRF, how it impacts, it might feed into the CK outline as Fabian and Amanda proposed. So at this point, I hand it off to you, Fabian, Amanda.
Yes. Do you want us to just organize the discussion, or?
Well, we can start off if you have any comments you'd like to start off with, and
comments.
Then otherwise just handle the hands.
Okay, I'll start off with some comments by other people. I don't see anybody raising his or her hand, so I'll start off with some comments and observations. Comments, obviously mainly from his perspective of the guy who was tasked together with Amanda, of course, to fit the various pieces together. And one thing seems to me obvious is that, Matthew introduced the notion of distinguishing between different levels of ontology development and starting out with what's called the conceptual, the logical, and the physical model level. And it seems to me that there's a disconnect between the way track A interpreted the scope of the work and track B approached it. Because it seems to me that track A was mainly focused on evaluating ontology on the conceptual and on the logical level. Looking at the content, looking at the consistency and all of that. And track B was almost exclusively concerned with ontology as software and part of bigger IT systems, which is, I guess, the physical level. Or maybe it's actually not even the physical level of ontology, Matthew's terminology, but the implementation of the physical model. So, which is, both is fine. But what we are missing, from my perspective, we have now a gap because we don't have, don't have anything about the external evaluation of the conceptual level on the conceptual level on the logical level. For example, the requirements that you get externally will determine the scope and the scope on two levels. On the conceptual level, that means which terms and relationships or classes and relationships and or classes and properties in our talk do you have to worry about. And then on the logical level, what axioms do you need in order to enable the capabilities that you're ultimately looking for. So that hasn't been covered in the summaries. And I think the reason for that is that there's just a hole, which was the result of different focusing on different layers and interpreting the scope in a way that there was just some gap as a result. Another observation is that I think we need really should be able to make some additional progress on getting the life cycle down. And I think each track provided some input. I mean, with Leo providing one Leo and Steve providing one way of carving it up, and then Mike Denny different way, and I think Matthew also talked a little bit about different aspects of the life cycle. I think we need to unify that and get it all together, and then link the requirements or the various aspects of quality into that, into the different do you need to care about which kind of quality for the life cycle? Because for example, if you assume that there is a stage where we are mostly concerned with the conceptual level, and then with where we basically capture the try to capture what needs to be covered on the vocabulary level, then that is, of course, the place where we would evaluate that aspect. And then when you go to the next stage where you do the axioms, you would do the evaluation of whether the axioms perform what they're supposed to or cover what they're supposed to cover, etc. So that were my two observations. Amanda?
I'd add an observation that I thought it was really interesting that Todd emphasized this the idea that the evaluation happens within a context, and that context has to do with the business environment or the usage characteristics, and that based on that context, the evaluation results can be ranked or considered differently. And I made a comment in the chat, but this seemed to me to be kind a different way of putting something that I and I think some others had put in a slightly different framework, saying at the beginning you have this usage context. Right, you start with this, and from that you derive requirements, and from that you derive what evaluation criteria are relevant at various, you know, life cycle stages. And so the evaluation, the specific evaluation events and processes that you apply are themselves defined by these contextual requirements and driven by them. And I put a question in there. I don't think either Todd didn't see it or I didn't see his response. But my question was, you know, do you agree that these are largely equivalent? But I sort of would open that up to other people if they see these as equivalent in the important senses. Of course, in practicality, they would look very different in terms of where you put effort. in one case, you would have a sort of general recipe for evaluation, and then you would decide what to pay attention to and how much. And in the other case, you'd spend a lot of time tailoring your evaluation recipe to just include what's relevant. So I guess that's a comment and an invitation for further comments or thoughts on it. And I think that's all I have to add up front. I'm interested in what other people have to say, or what people think we might be getting right on or slightly off or missing.
Now, one thing I'd also like to point out, so there's just been a few questions just here. I Todd had to leave at, I guess, what, 10 minutes ago, but he put a comment in the chat. There's kind of been this discussion here about the whether to keep the distinction between intrinsic and extrinsic criteria. But I'd just like to draw attention to the actual outline, which you can access. We have the link there. So I think that in the actual communique, there is going to be a slightly different structuring of the material, I believe. Fabian, did you want to make any comments about this, like how the distinctions or how that, say, track structure maps into the outline?
Yes, I completely agree with Todd that the distinction between internal and external has been an initial way of trying to carve out, you know, different tracks and. Doing over the whole summit, at least I also agree that it has not been a very good distinction. I don't think it has been a very helpful distinction, because it's just too, the gray area between the two is too much, and it's not helping very much. So I agree with this. In the outline that we provided, we didn't really make the distinction. We just had, what we started out with was the question is, you know, what are the criteria under which we should evaluate, and how should we go about evaluating? What are the metrics? That is an interesting question. And that basically covers both track A and track B. And then another part, then there were other subheadings. One was about what methodologies should one embrace in order to achieve something which works well and meets the quality criteria. And the last one was what tools are there. So the distinction between external and internal does not, as far as I see, doesn't play a big role in the communique. I like the idea of putting the life cycle phases at the center, as Todd suggested. Obviously, that will require us to condense the various perspectives on life cycle and come up with one model everybody can agree on.
If I can make a further comment on that, I agree with what Fabian just said. I want to add that I think there are, and we've seen in the different materials, there are many different ways of slicing and dicing ontology characteristics or requirements or evaluation criteria. And there'll even be sort of different versions of ones like extrinsic and intrinsic. What's more important is that we actually understand what these characteristics are, how they matter, when they matter, and how one can evaluate them. And having those sort of in a flattish, less organized sense, less sliced and diced sense, it's more important than the choosing one particular way to cluster them. And I think that there are lots of different ways to do it, that different tools take and so forth, and it's we can acknowledge those without taking them to be the most important thing to understand.
Okay, I think Steve is. Michael, are you managing?
No, go ahead. You can do moderate.
Okay, Steve.
Okay, yeah, I just
why the distinction matters.
I actually really agree with what Amanda just said. There are many ways to slice and dice. I do think that slicing and dicing along the life cycle is one way. In my comment on the chat around 6 minutes, I think it was past the hour, that has more to do, I think, with when or what phase of maturity you do it. The intrinsic, extrinsic, or something like it is more about what are you looking for. And I also support the idea that, who was it here? I was just agreeing with Michael Denny, who is suggesting another slicing and dicing, model quality versus domain fidelity versus application fitness, at 12 minutes past the hour on the chat. But I further agree with Amanda, we can slice and dice till kingdom come. We don't want to probably get into all of those in the communique, but they're useful in various contexts, depending on what one is trying to do. So I'm not sure you want to pick a particular one like that. I actually like the way you guys are headed on the communique outline as you have it now. That's all.
Thank you. Yeah, I think some. Clearly in presenting it, we need to some form of structuring it, and I think I just hope that you trust us that we will find right. We don't need to trust you. We will find one way of doing it in the draft, and then you can all criticize us for doing it the way we did. But I completely agree with Amanda and you. Ultimately, the slicing and dicing is more means of how to organize the document, and the meat is the content. Leo.
Okay, sorry. Yes, I was muted. I basically wanted to say, yeah, I agree with Steve and some of the other comments that the life cycle is important, but it's also that at each point in the life cycle, you know, the issue with intrinsic and extrinsic is that there's these range of criteria that we can characterize in some sense, and they are different. And we think we can characterize it. It just may be that each individual thing that we can talk about as properties or criteria will vary depending upon where you are in the life cycle. So early on in the life cycle, it's maybe unimportant to bring in domain or application requirements because you want to, even though they're already the input, you want to make sure that what you have initially is consistent and maybe granular enough to satisfy, you know, the conceptualization you initially have, even though it's incomplete. So I think you need both. So it's more like a multi-dimensional, you know, like a matrix or something, with some things necessary and some things, you know, sufficient, and some things both at different places, but with qualitative differences during the individual life cycle phases. So, Farben, Amanda, do you have any final comments? Otherwise, I'll just kind of move on to the just reminding people of the schedule over the next few weeks. Because from here on in, we will be focusing completely on the communique development and critique. Okay.
Well, one comment I have is that I think we will have to work at some degree within the next week with all of you to consolidate the life cycle, the different life cycles. So and then I think it would be important to tag some of the content that has been provided now without an explicit reference to the life cycle to the life cycles. So again, you know, using the same example, looking at what are the external criteria or what are the criteria of the fitness to what's the application? Is that what Michael Denny said? Something along this line. What are the application fitness criteria that are important in the, you know, in the first, in the second, and third phase of the life cycle? And first, of course, we need to come up with a description of these life cycles. So Amanda and I will probably, get together and come up with an early draft and then contact you and get more input.
Okay, so if you look on the communique page, so what we have over the next few weeks, so 1 week from today, April 11th, we will have the first track, the first draft. Of the communique, and we'll have a general discussion about that. Fabian and Amanda will be, I think you'll be kind of chairing that session. The week after that, actually the schedule here looks a bit off. I think on April 18th, we have a second session that we'll be dealing with. Let's see, what do we have here? Yeah, on April 11th, the communique draft review. On April 18th, it'll be the final communique review, and that there's that session. And I guess we have a meeting on the 25th. Then would be Do we have a meeting on the 25th? I can't remember or not. Because then the final draft will be completed on May 1st, and we'll have
yes.
a symposium on May 2nd and 3rd.
Yes, there is a meeting on the 25th, but that would generally be like the preparation for the symposium.
Right, so that would be more of a symposium.
It would not be devoted to the communique.
Right.
So in an earlier plan, April 18th would be the final draft instead of May 1st. Is that agreeable to
you? Yeah, just drawing attention to that, because in our schedule, it's April 18th. So, Fabian, Amanda, is that okay?
Is April 18th, is that a discussion of the draft, or is it, does you say it's the final draft?
No, I think so Peter, I think the 18th is kind of the final communique review, and then I think Fabian and Amanda will take all of those comments at that point, and then, kind of it'll produce the final draft on the basis of the comments on the 18th.
That's my understanding.
That's my understanding too. Yeah.
Okay. Let me update. Does that look good on the draft page? So 11th first draft discussion.
Yeah.
18th final draft discussion. May 1st final draft release is a publication and then presentation.
Good. Yeah. Okay.
Would May 1st and 2nd be too close, or should that release be April 25th?
I have, for some reason, from an earlier calendar or something, I have on my calendar a final draft candidate released on the 25th.
Why don't you modify that calendar right now on the wiki page?
Yeah.
Why would you?
We all agree.
Wait a minute. The 25th. I thought the 25th is the Justin meeting for the symposium.
I didn't have anything.
Right. It's a meeting. I mean, the release the spot has to take up a meeting.
Okay, but I mean, does it matter whether we? Why the 25th then?
And if you want, let's keep it on day one.
Yeah, we'll keep it on this the current schedule
okay.
here that we revised.
That's fine.
Yeah. Okay. So it was a great session today. A lot of great ideas. And we are converging, I think, definitely converging on the communique. So talk to everyone next week, April 11th, and we'll be discussing the first draft of the communique for Ontology Summit 2013. Thanks a lot, everyone. Talk to you next week.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.